Hi, today is Friday, July 12, 2024. My name's Harold Topper, and I'll be reading selected articles from today's editions of the New York Times, the Stanford Advocate, and the Norwalk Hour. First article from the Norwalk Hour. Norwalk developer addresses runoff concerns at construction site for controversial apartment complex. Byline Catherine Lucci, Dateline Norwalk. The developer of a large mixed-use apartment complex addressed concerns about runoff from the Mill Pond construction site, reassuring a city commission that the filtration system is working. Per the conditions of approval for the controversial development in East Norwalk, Mill Pond Holding LLC returned to the Planning and Zoning Commission on Wednesday to share its updated facade plan. During the discussion, Planning and Zoning Commissioner Anna Tabachnik said she noticed that the pond off the site had turned brown recently. Multiple times when there were heavy rains in Mill Pond browned, and when I peeked through as well as I could see, a number of the silt fences were down, Tabachnik said. She asked whether the system was working correctly and if it is checked regularly. We didn't used to have the mill pond turning brown like that from runoff before there were humongous piles of dirt, Tabachnik said, of the construction work. Demolition of the old Wells Fargo Bank and site began this spring to make way for a 77-unit apartment and mixed-use development that many East Norwalk residents heavily protested due to its size. There has been a brief pause in work until the final building permits are issued, Mill Pond's Representative Henry Conroy said. We've put all the sediment and erosion control in place per the plan and for the approval of this commission, Conroy said. We check on it daily, and we absolutely check on it during and after all rainstorms. I personally have lifted grates and cleared debris out of filter fabric just because I want to make sure that everything's operating appropriately. Planning and zoning staff have also visited the site to inspect the system, Conroy said. We found that it seems that everything is working appropriately, he added. Mill Pond revised some elements of the facade plan after comments from their peer review about breaking up the mass of the building. Colin Grothier, a senior associate at Beinfeld Architecture, walked through the minor changes. We revised that to provide more definition between the, quote, three sisters, end quote, and the, quote, market building, end quote, and kind of separate those roof lines and just give it a little more character, Grothier said. The main northern facade is predominantly broken up into four facade types: the Italianate, the mansion, the three sisters, and the market building. The intent of the different facade styles is to make the building feel less massive on Cemetery Street. The new design has more distinctive divisions between facade types. We feel like we really accomplished that intent of reducing the massing and providing more distinct separation between the two buildings, Grothier said. Conroy said the pace of the work at One Cemetery Street site will be picking up soon. We demolished the bank building and we have some ground improvement work and site work to continue, Conroy said. I would say over the next 30 days we'll be in full swing of construction up until the site is 100% complete. When complete, Mill Pond will have 77 apartment units and some commercial office and rent retail space across two buildings. The main building will have 2,890 square feet of retail space at the corner of East Avenue and Cemetery Street. The second building resembles a house and will offer office space on the first floor and apartments on the second floor. Unit types will range from 1 and 2 bedroom units to 3 and 4 bedroom units, with second-story loft space. Parking will be located under and outside the development. Moving now to the next article in the Norwalk Hour. Connecticut contractor violated safety regulations in trench collapse that killed worker, agency says. Byline Jessica Bravo, Dateline New Canaan. An Easton contractor was in violation of several workplace safety regulations after an investigation into the death of an employee at a New Canaan worksite, according to federal officials. The U.S. Department of Labor said in a news release that Sound Construction was in violation of several, quote, safety standards for excavations, end quote, while five employees were working on repairing a water line at Silver Hill Hospital in New Canaan. The incident occurred at Silver Hill Hospital on December 22, 2023, and the worker was inside a, quote, hospital's fire suppression system when he was injured, end quote, New Canaan Fire Chief Albert Bassett said. He added that the worker was transported to Norwalk Hospital after the incident. The Department of Labor confirmed the worker died but did not specify how long after the incident the death occurred. The agency added that Sound Construction failed to provide cave-in protection, proper training on trenches, failed to ensure an excavator was at an appropriate distance from the trench, and did not, quote, verify the location of underground utilities and/or structures prior to excavation, end quote. In 2016, Sound Construction was cited for similar violations at a job site in Trumbull, according to the Department of Labor. The agency added that the Occupational Safety and Health Administration proposed $394,083 in penalties as a result of the 2023 fatality. Despite prior warnings, Sound Construction ignored trench safety protections, and that decision cost an employee their life, said Bridgeport OSHA Area Director Catherine Brescia. All employers should make workplace safety a priority or risk being responsible for leaving the family, friends, and coworkers of one or more of their employees to grieve this kind of preventable death. Moving now to the next Norwalk Hour article. Ex-Norwalk Middle School Guidance Counselor Sexually Assaulted Student, Police Say. Byline, Pat Tomlinson and Liz Hardaway. Dateline, Norwalk. A 47-year-old, now former guidance counselor, is accused of performing sexual acts and, quote, lap dances, end quote, on an adolescent student in her office at Nathan Hale Middle School, according to an arrest warrant application. Norwalk police charged Luisa Melchion of New Canaan on Thursday with second-degree sexual assault and two counts of risk of injury to a minor. Police said Melchion no longer is employed by Norwalk Public Schools. A spokesperson with the school district said Melchion no longer was with the district as of June 14th. Melchion's attorney, Mark Sherman, said she resigned from the position. Melchion of New Canaan was being held in lieu of $500,000 bail and was arraigned at State Superior Court in Stamford Thursday, according to Norwalk Police Sergeant Ryan Evarts. A judge decided Thursday to keep Melchion's bail at $500,000. If she posts bond, she must undergo GPS monitoring, intensive probation services, and house arrest. She also was ordered not to have any unsupervised contact with minors except her three children. Sherman said his client was expected to post bond Thursday. Melchion's case was transferred to the Part A docket, where the district's most serious matters are heard. She is next scheduled to appear in court September 6th. Norwalk Police Detective Patrick English wrote in an arrest warrant affidavit that a man contacted the department on April 24th and, quote, reported he had information regarding a Norwalk public school teacher having an inappropriate relationship with a student, end quote. The man told police that Melchion, who was a friend, had let him borrow her cell phone because his was damaged. While using the phone, he found messages between her and a student that, quote, appeared sexual in nature, end quote, the affidavit said. The informant later provided investigators with 17 screenshots, which included explicit photos of Melchion, money transactions, and text conversations that were, quote, sexual in nature, end quote, between the then guidance counselor and a, quote, child, end quote, student at Nathan Hale Middle School, English wrote. The informant would not provide his identity to police, but said that he, quote, felt that he needed to tell police for the child's safety, end quote, according to the affidavit. Norwalk police informed Ed Singleton, a principal in the school district, on April 30th of the allegations, according to the affidavit. It is unknown whether the school district took any action against Melchion when they learned of the allegations at this time. A spokesperson with the district declined to comment on whether Melchione was placed on leave. State Attorney Paul Forensic said in court Thursday that the student was 13 years old. When interviewed by police, the child said, quote, he didn't want to get anyone in trouble, end quote, but agreed to speak with investigators, according to the affidavit. During these discussions, he admitted to receiving nude photos from Melchione, as well as money transactions for, quote, Uber rides and food, end quote, English wrote in the affidavit. The child told police that Melchione also asked him to send her explicit pictures, but, quote, he was uncomfortable, end quote, about doing it, English wrote. Despite his discomfort, the child said he eventually complied, according to the affidavit. In a statement Thursday, Norwalk Public Schools said the safety of its students is its first concern. Norwalk Public Schools is cooperating with the Norwalk Police Department's investigation and has no further comment, said Emily Morgan, a spokesperson for the district. Stanford-based criminal defense lawyer Mark Sherman, who is representing Melchione, stressed that despite the nature of the charges, Louisa is still very much entitled to the presumption of innocence. These are just accusations, he continued. What we do know is that these charges are being brought against a devoted wife and mother who has dedicated over 20 years to her profession, and it's going to take some time to investigate this case. This article was also the headline article in the Stanford Advocate. Moving to the next article in the Stanford Advocate. Quote, 27 units sound absurd to me, end quote. Stanford residents rails against Hope Street townhomes. Byline Tyler Fedor, Dateline Stanford. Residents around Hope Street railed against a proposed development of townhomes during the Zoning Board's July 8th meeting, saying it would cause traffic problems or lead the way to more development. The proposed development would bring 26 new three-bedroom townhomes to 91 Hope Street. Each unit will have a garage with a proposed total of 95 parking spaces for just over 2-acre area. Single-family homes are located to the north and east of the proposed development, and other multifamily home housing is south and west. The developers want to rezone the land from R71/2, mostly single-family homes, to RM1, which allows for multifamily dwellings. Both zones limit a density. The lot, as of July 8th, holds a single-family home, which will remain on the site, a detached garage, large driveway, and a church. The existing home on the lot was still present on plans for the development dated July 1st. The site is owned by the Diocese of Bridgeport and was previously used as a Haitian American community center. A previous version of the development planned for 44 units. The Planning Board, June 2023, approved a change to the city's master plan, which guides the city's approach to development for 10 years, to allow the project to move forward. The lot at 91 Hope Street was split into two different master plan categories. The amendment consolidated the lot to encompass a single master plan category that allowed for residential low-density multifamily developments. Several residents around the development, though, said they had concerns about the potential increase in traffic in the area. Another worried that others around the development could sell their property, inviting more development into the area. Hillel Disraeli has lived on Nash Place for almost 48 years and told zoning board members that traffic from the development could mean, quote, going to work could be an accident waiting to happen, end quote. He also called the developer's traffic assessment, quote, wrong and worthless, end quote. The assessment was reviewed by the city's Transportation, Traffic, and Parking Department. Attorney Joseph Capalbo, who represented the developer, said, I think that it's safe to rely on the experts with it, Capalbo said. Patricia Romano echoed the worry about the traffic generated by the development. She lives on Pierce Place and is also worried about people selling their homes if the development goes forward as, quote, the dominoes start to fall, end quote, she said. And bigger developments take the place of homes like the ones now on Howes Avenue and Pierce Place. But 27 units sound absurd to me, Romano said. That sounds like way too many. Carolyn Roth lives on Howe Avenue and worried that the height of the townhomes could give the residents of the development a, quote, direct line of sight into my home and outdoor space, end quote. One proposed townhome could be 28 feet and 7 inches tall. Her home is just across the property line from the proposed development. This invasion of privacy would make it difficult for my family to enjoy our property without feeling constantly observed, Roth said. Len D'Andrea, president and engineer in charge of land use consulting firm Rocco V. D'Andrea, Inc., said there would be no windows on the unit's north-facing side. There are windows on the front of the units, according to design documents. The back areas of the units would be filled to create a backyard that is higher than the streets in front of the townhomes, plans show. A sticking point was whether the proposed buildings would be too high for the zoning. The applicants are seeking to rezone the area to RM-1, which means buildings can be no more than 2.5 stories and no more than 30 feet tall. The zoning board was unsure if the proposed townhomes should be considered 2.5 stories tall or 3.5 stories tall. Ravi Ahuja, architect for the project, said the buildings are 2.5 stories tall based on his interpretation of the zoning regulations that would categorize the garage as a basement, since the plan is to fill in the backyard of the units to create recreation space. The fill would make the backyard higher than the development's roads and about the height of the underground garage's ceiling. Basements are not counted toward how many stories a building is, he claimed. Stanford Land Use Bureau Chief Ralph Blessing, however, disagreed with Ahuja and said the filling can't be used to determine how tall a building is, but wanted zoning enforcement officials to take a look at the proposed development. The project was continued to the next zoning board meeting later in July. Moving now to the next front page article in the Stanford Advocate. Police identify Stanford man found dead in New Canaan Woods. Byline Jessica Bravo, Dateline New Canaan. The body of a Stanford man found in the woods earlier this week has been identified, according to local police. Public Information Officer Lieutenant Mark D. Felice said in a news release that the man was identified as Santos Ijedo Perez, but did not give the man's age. D. Felice said New Canaan officers, along with Connecticut State Police, are investigating the death, but there was no indication of foul play. In a statement to Stanford families Thursday morning, West Hill High School principal Michael Rinaldi said Perez was a student at the school. He added that Perez was found, quote, near his summer job at a construction site in New Canaan, end quote. Rinaldi added that resources will be available to grieving students and staff from 8 a.m. to 12 p.m. on Thursday and Friday. New Canaan police began helping Stanford police in the disappearance of Perez Monday, according to DeFelice. He added that Perez, quote, was last reported seen working at a house under renovation during the afternoon hours within the town of New Canaan, end quote. Perez was located minutes after midnight Tuesday and was pronounced dead by a responding paramedic, DeFelice said. The Occupational Safety and Health Administration was notified of the death, DeFelice said. The death remains under investigation, but DeFelice reiterated that there was no threat to public safety. Moving now to the next front page article in the Stanford Advocate. Lamont creates new housing authority to push towns to build more market rate units. David Kouris, president of the Downtown Business District in Stanford, named executive director of the new agency. Byline Ken Dixon, Dateline Hartford. Connecticut is a state that needs about 90,000 units of new housing based on the number of job vacancies, but many suburban and rural communities have been reluctant to build. On Thursday, Governor Ned Lamont hoped to change all that as he swore in members of a new quasi-public state agency aimed at persuading local officials with hundreds of millions of dollars in incentives and expertise. During the inaugural meeting of the Board of Directors of the Municipal Redevelopment Authority, which was created by the General Assembly as part of the state budget process in 2023, state and local officials joined members of the private sector in trying to kickstart efforts to expand housing opportunities that have been slow to progress, despite efforts of lawmakers, including retiring state senator Marilyn Moore, Democrat from Bridgeport, co-chairwoman of the Housing Committee. I'm hoping that this will be the beginning of doing something and that there is a place to go to try to bring all those things together beyond a commission, beyond the roundtable that we did, Moore said Thursday, after the authority's organizational meeting. Instead of talk, maybe we'll get some action out of this. Speaking to reporters after the 40-minute meeting, Lamont noted that various geographic areas are represented by the authority's board, which will be led by Chairperson Felix Reyes, New London's Director of Economic Development and Planning. You see them at the table right there, Lamont said. We're saying I want you to take the lead on this, and most of them are. I think you're seeing more housing being built right now than we've had in the last 15-plus years. We've got to keep that momentum going. Interest rates can be a little bit of a headwind. David Corris, president of the Downtown Business District in Stamford and volunteer director of the State Port Authority, was chosen as the executive director of the new authority, which goes by the acronym of MRDA. A former planning director for the city of Bridgeport, Corris will be paid $240,000 annually for the job. If I had crafted a job that was designed for my interest and my expertise and what I've been doing over the last 20 years, I couldn't have crafted anything better than this position, Corris told the board, which had gathered in a third-floor meeting room at the State Capitol building. There are dozens and dozens of municipalities that want to grow, that want to provide new housing opportunities, that want to foster economic development, and this authority is designed to help them realize how to do it. So, I really hope what the MRDA ultimately achieves is to provide that support structure that can be deployed to the willing municipalities to help them achieve their objectives. I think David Corris is the guy to help bring all these pieces together, Lamont said. I cannot keep this economy growing and opportunity for everybody unless there's a place for people to live. The governor said that the attraction of $300 to $400 million in annual state support should act as a powerful incentive for transit-oriented development, combined with expanded water and sewer assistance and relief from state affordable housing laws that some towns complain are unreasonably weighted on the sides of developers. Show us your plan, Lamont said of local officials throughout Connecticut. Just don't show us no plan. During the meeting, Lamont said that since taking office in 2019, his administration has helped create more than 25,000 units, with another 5,000 units in the permitting process. I'd like towns and municipalities to tell where they want that housing to go, he said. Give us an idea of where the growth zones are. We're trying to speed up the process the best we can. The 16-member board includes state commissioners, town planners, leaders of nonprofit agencies, business owners, and Matt Brockman, the governor's chief of staff. Brockman called the board an, quote, all-star, end quote, cast of experts with the goal of becoming a, quote, well-respected, impactful partner, end quote, in the effort to expand the state's housing base. Will hopefully facilitate quicker abilities for the state and the various agencies to engage with the cities and towns and move contracts along, Brockman said, stressing the goal of helping communities to identify properties that can be developed for market-rate housing, including potential financing. The hope is that this board can be nimble in its work. Initial goals will be for board members, who will meet monthly, to reach out to towns and cities to participate in the voluntary program, which could require local changes in zoning ordinances that sometimes slow down development projects. There are no death notices in today's Stamford Advocate and Norwalk Hour. Moving now to the New York Times and a front page article. Biden's isolation deepens as doubters' ranks grow. Even some of his own aides are weighing how to persuade him to drop out. This article is by Michael S. Schmidt, Katie Rogers, and Peter Baker. Dateline Washington. President Biden found himself increasingly isolated on Thursday as a small group of his longtime aides and advisors have become convinced that he will have to make what they see as the painful but inevitable decision to abandon his campaign for re-election, according to three people who have been briefed on the matter. In recent days, the group has been trying to come up with ways to persuade Mr. Biden to step aside from the campaign. Those discussions were recounted by three people familiar with them who, like others in this article, spoke on the condition of anonymity to discuss a sensitive situation. There is no indication that any of the discussions have reached Mr. Biden himself, one of the informed people said. The effort comes after a disastrous debate performance in Atlanta 2 weeks ago plunged Mr. Biden's candidacy into crisis. He is facing pressure from all sides. Lawmakers on Capitol Hill are vacillating between tepid support and outright calls for him to drop out, and those calls were being echoed by some of the wealthiest donors in the party. At the center of it all is Mr. Biden, who is convinced that he is the only one who can beat former President Donald J. Trump, according to people familiar with this thinking, and who is unlikely to be persuaded otherwise by people outside his insular inner circle, which includes his family. Mr. Biden was hoping to put some concerns to rest in a high-stakes news conference on Thursday night after the NATO summit in Washington. In an early stumble before it even got underway, he flubbed his introduction of President Volodymyr Zelensky of Ukraine, saying, "Ladies and gentlemen, President Putin." After a moment, Mr. Biden realized his mistake, came back to the microphone, and quickly said, "President Putin? We're going to beat President Putin. President Zelensky. I'm so focused on beating Putin, we got to worry about it." The small group of Mr. Biden's advisors in the administration and the campaign, at least two of whom have told allies that they do not believe he should keep trying to run for a second term, said they would need to convince the president of several things for him to leave the race. They said they would have to make the case that he cannot win against Mr. Trump. They would have to convince him that another candidate, like Vice President Kamala Harris, could beat Mr. Trump. And they would have to assure Mr. Biden that, should he choose to step aside, the process to choose another candidate would be orderly and not devolve into chaos in the Democratic Party. The internal deliberations reflect a growing standoff between Mr. Biden and his party since his disastrous debate performance. The White House denied the account. Unequivocally, "This is not true," said Andrew Bates, a White House spokesman. "President Biden's team is strongly behind him." T.J. Ducklow, a spokesman for the Biden campaign, said the same for the president's political staff. "Patently false," he said. "This team stands with the president." The people who are closest to the president, a group that includes some of his longest-serving advisors and members of his family, remain adamant that Mr. Biden will stay in the race. The conversations about the president's dropping out of the race have been happening outside that small orbit, but include some of his most loyal allies. Senate Democrats aired their concerns about Mr. Biden's electability in a two-hour lunch meeting on Thursday with senior Biden campaign officials. Senators emerged from the private meeting, which was held a block from the Capitol at the headquarters of the party's Senate campaign arm, skeptical and mostly unmoved, though no new defectors in that chamber immediately came out with calls for Mr. Biden to drop out of the race. Still, after a session suffused with frustration and sadness, few Democrats said their reservations had been resolved. Senator Richard Blumenthal, Democrat of Connecticut, told reporters that he needed to see more evidence to convince him that Mr. Biden still has a clear path to victory. "Some of my concerns are allayed. Some others have been deepened," Mr. Blumenthal said after the closed-door meeting with Mike Donilon and Steve Ricchetti, two of Mr. Biden's top advisors, and his campaign's chairwoman, Jennifer O'Malley Dillon. "I need more of the kind of analytics that show the path to success." Inside the meeting, some senators voiced frustration that the only data presented was some top-line polling numbers showing that Mr. Biden was ahead with black voters and women, according to an attendee who described the discussion on the condition of anonymity. many senators expressed worries about the fate of their colleagues in competitive re-election races, while Mr. Biden's team gave a presentation premised on the notion that Mr. Biden was staying in the race. The attendee described a sense of general sadness in the room. "I think you should ask Joe Biden if he can win," Senator Jeff Merkley, Democrat of Oregon, told reporters who asked afterward about his confidence in Mr. Biden's viability. The president told confidants before his disastrous debate showing on June 27th that he believed he had a better chance of prevailing in the election than Ms. Harris did, according to a person told of the matter. Two people close to the president said he remained sure that he had a better chance of success. Mr. Biden's campaign is quietly testing the strength of Ms. Harris against former President Donald J. Trump in a head-to-head survey of voters. The survey, which is being conducted this week and was commissioned by the Biden campaign's analytics team, is believed to be the first time since the debate that Mr. Biden's aides have sought to measure how the vice president would fare at the top of the ticket. It was described by three people who were informed about it and who spoke on condition of anonymity because of the sensitive nature of the information. A majority of Democrats feel that Mr. Biden should step aside, according to a Washington Post ABC News Ipsos poll published on Thursday. The poll also showed that the race remains close between Mr. Trump and Mr. Biden, but that Ms. Harris would fare slightly better if she were to replace him on the ballot. Mr. Biden and his advisors have long dismissed polling that shows concern over his age or ability to serve, and have been encouraged that polls continue to show a tight race between Mr. Biden and Mr. Trump 2 weeks after the debate. The consensus inside Mr. Biden's operation is that it will take hard numbers to convince him, particularly polling showing that his support has eroded significantly. The decision by the respected Cook Political Report this week to move six key states in the Electoral College in Mr. Trump's direction reflected the mounting electoral challenge he faces. But some polls have shown that Mr. Biden is still within striking distance of Mr. Trump, and that may bolster his belief that he can still recover. A memo written by two top Biden campaign officials and distributed to staff on Thursday reaffirmed the view that Mr. Biden is still the best candidate to beat Mr. Trump. "The movement we have seen, while real, is not a sea change in the state of the race," the memo, written by Ms. O'Malley Dillon and Julia Chavez Rodriguez, Mr. Biden's campaign manager, said. The president's team had felt bullish earlier in the week after a hard push on Monday to silence his Democratic critics, which included an open letter to Congress, a cable news call-in, a presidential appearance on a top donor call, and a meeting with the Congressional Black Caucus. But any progress in moving past the debate was undone early on Wednesday when former Speaker Nancy Pelosi said Mr. Biden still had a decision to make about whether or not he was running, nearly a week after he told Democratic governors and the ABC anchor George Stephanopoulos that he was staying in the race. Ms. Pelosi delivered her message, implying that Mr. Biden could reconsider his candidacy on, quote, Morning Joe, end quote, the MSNBC show Mr. Biden often wakes up to watch. It was the same program to which the president had phoned in for an interview on Monday to declare that he was committed to running. Moving now to the next related article in the New York Times. Quote, "No poll says that," end quote. Biden digs in as Democratic fears deepen. The president put on a competent showing of his pressure cooker of a news conference, but it remained in doubt if he could stem the bleeding of Democratic support. Byline Shane Goldmacher, Lisa Lehrer, and Reed J. Epstein. Days after President Biden said only the, quote, Lord Almighty, end quote, could drive him from the race, he laid out a far more earthy scenario at his closely watched news conference on Thursday night. His advisors would have to prove to him that he was headed for certain defeat. But leaning into the microphone and whispering to dramatize his defiance, Mr. Biden made clear that he did not foresee this happening. "No one's saying that," he said. "No poll says that." He seemed to open the door to an alternative, then swiftly shut it. Sure, quote, other people can beat Trump, end quote, he said, but it would be too hard to, quote, start from scratch, end quote. The president's first news conference since the debate amounted to a competent presentation, if not a compelling performance. But it remained in doubt whether it was enough to stop the bleeding of Democratic support that has threatened to hemorrhage. Minutes after he left the stage, the drip, drip, drip of Democratic members of Congress calling for him to step aside continued unabated. "I believe I'm the best qualified to govern," said Mr. Biden, who has for decades pointed to naysayers to fuel his own comeback narratives. "And I think I'm the best qualified to win." The high-stakes, mostly unscripted hour, Mr. Biden's longest since the debate that sent his candidacy into a tailspin, came as some of those around him have talked about how to persuade him to drop out, and as his campaign has commissioned a survey to test the strength of Vice President Kamala Harris in a matchup he has insisted would never come to pass. On Thursday, Mr. Biden at times flashed his rising frustration with those paid to help him, blaming staff members directly for his overstuffed schedule and obliquely for some of the recent reporting on his candidacy. By the time Mr. Biden finished his first solo news conference this year, Republicans seemed more pleased with his steady showing, hoping a wounded Mr. Biden would soldier on, than Democrats were. Many in the party now worry that every unscripted Biden appearance through November will be a hold-your-breath moment. "We don't have a Democratic Party problem, we have a Joe Biden problem," said Pete Giangreco, a former campaign advisor to President Barack Obama, who worries about Mr. Biden's ability to drive a message against former President Donald J. Trump. "He can't deliver the message medicine to cure the disease because it's always going to be about what's wrong with him." David Polyansky, a Republican strategist who has worked on past presidential campaigns, including that of Governor Ron DeSantis of Florida last year, described Democrats as, quote, "stuck in the mud," end quote. "They have a sitting president who is no longer capable of winning re-election or even proving to the public he can do the job effectively," he said, "but apparently not bad enough for Democratic power brokers to move him out." Some Democrats were hoping that former Speaker Nancy Pelosi, who suggested pointedly that Mr. Biden had a decision to make just days after he said he had decided, would take the lead as a fellow octogenarian who gave way gracefully and in her own time for the next generation of leaders. Mr. Biden was quick to dismiss the talk consuming his party that he has been diminished by time. When a reporter suggested that he had acknowledged his limits at age 81, he pushed back with disbelief. Quote, "The limits I have acknowledged, I have," end quote. Yet even as he waved off reporting about his need for earlier bedtimes, he confirmed he needed more rest. "It'd be smarter for me to pace myself a little more," he said of a job that rarely offers much respite. He tried to spin his seniority as an advantage with the kind of prepared line that allies had hoped he would deliver at the debate. "The only thing age does is help you with. It creates a little bit of wisdom if you pay attention," Mr. Biden said. The post-debate problem is how closely everyone is paying attention, magnifying every mumble and mistake. And the news conference was far from flawless. Mr. Biden flubbed the very first answer, referring to Vice President Trump instead of Vice President Harris. He cut himself off more than once. "Look, folks, this is, well, anyway," he said. But he also held his own, comfortably wading into the complexity of foreign affairs, the conflict in Gaza, as well as the relationship between China and Russia, without the sputtering stoppages that defined his debate performance 2 weeks earlier. It was a level of fluency that, at the least, complicated the case for ousting an incumbent president who still wants to run. Mr. Biden was prideful and even a tinge defensive about his achievements. Days after he had denounced, quote, "elites," end quote, lining up against him, Mr. Biden was citing elites, including Nobel laureates, who had praised him. Quote, "Find me an economist, a mainstream economist, who said we haven't done well," end quote, he said. "How can I say this without sounding too self-serving?" Mr. Biden wondered aloud at another point. He had barely finished speaking when the defections resumed. Representative Jim Himes of Connecticut, the top Democrat on the House Intelligence Committee, became the latest lawmaker to call for Mr. Biden to step aside. "We must put forth the strongest candidate," he said. He was soon joined by Representative Scott Peters of California and Eric Sorensen of Illinois, who became the 18th congressional Democrat to call for Mr. Biden to leave the race. Mr. Biden, in the news conference and his campaign in a memo earlier on Thursday, argued that it was time to move past the debate and unite behind him. They indicated little shift in strategy, arguing that the race could still be a referendum on Mr. Trump and what he might do in a second term. "The surest way to help Donald Trump is to spend his convention talking about our nominating process instead of the MAGA extremism that will be on stage in Milwaukee," said the memo, which was signed by the campaign chair, Jennifer O'Malley Dillon, and the campaign manager, Julie Chavez Rodriguez. The news conference resulted in a bizarre and bipartisan symmetry on social media, where Republicans and White House aides were both celebrating Mr. Biden's performance, albeit for wildly different reasons. "Joe Biden is crushing it. Build back better," Richard Grenell, a Trump loyalist who hopes to become Secretary of State, wrote in a post dripping with sarcasm. "Tonight, President Biden was knowledgeable, engaging, and capable," posted Senator Chris Coons, a confidant of the president from his home state, Delaware. "No one is more prepared to lead our nation forward than Joe Biden." Democrats have demanded that Mr. Biden do more to reassure the public, roughly three-quarters of which sees him as too old to do the job effectively. And his next test is set for Monday in a sit-down interview with Lester Holt of NBC News that will coincide with the first night of the Republican National Convention. Mr. Biden's final three words on Thursday revealed much about the state of the race that has overwhelmingly been fixated on him for the last 2 weeks. They were a plea to start focusing on his opponent. "Listen to him," Mr. Biden said of Mr. Trump. Moving now to the next front page article in the New York Times. Record heat persists, stunning even forecasters. Las Vegas hits 118 and millions are under weather alerts. Byline Alan Blinder and Isabel Taft. Dateline Las Vegas. For their anniversary road trip through the West, an escape from the human misery of a Louisiana summer, Tyson and Adeline Maddox rented a glimmering convertible. "They have kept the top on. It has been too hot to do anything else. Reminds me of the engine room," Mr. Maddox grumbled of the weather as he left the, quote, "Welcome to Fabulous Las Vegas," end quote, sign on Wednesday evening, when temperatures were still well into triple digits. "The heat, it's just constantly coming," Ms. Maddox added later. "It's like being in front of an exhaust pipe." So it has been around the Las Vegas area this week. Pedestrians sometimes felt scarcer than jackpots. Playgrounds stood empty and silent. Merely walking through a parking lot meant squinting, not at the sunlight blanketing the region, but at a heat so punishing that eyes hurt without ever actually watering. At times, the mercury's ticks upward have come so fast that forecasters, at once awestruck and unnerved, could hardly keep up. Remember 20 minutes ago when hitting 117 degrees Fahrenheit was a big deal? The local National Weather Service office wrote on social media on Wednesday. Well, the airport hit 118 degrees Fahrenheit. Thursday was not shaping up to be much of a reprieve at all. More than 60 million Americans were under heat alerts from the National Weather Service on Thursday, as a searing heat wave that has engulfed the West for more than a week continued to blister the region. Dangerously high temperatures are forecast to last there through Saturday and shift east to the central and eastern U.S. by Sunday. In southeast Texas, where Hurricane Beryl left millions of residents without power on Monday, people sweltered without air conditioning and Houston area hospitals were, quote, backed up, end quote, because doctors were wary of discharging patients to homes without power, officials said Wednesday. By Thursday afternoon, nearly 1.1 million CenterPoint Energy customers were still without electricity as the heat index in Houston pushed toward 98. The company said that it hoped to get the lights back on for 400,000 customers by the end of Friday, but that about 500,000 customers would probably still be without power into next week. Across the West, large parts of California, Nevada, Arizona, and Utah were under excessive heat warnings, indicating, quote, extremely dangerous heat conditions, end quote. Officials believe heat may be to blame for more than 90 deaths reported in the West this month, though it could take months of investigation for the authorities to determine an accurate death toll. More than a dozen high-temperature records were expected to fall on Thursday from the West Coast to the High Plains, where temperatures were predicted to soar from the upper 90s into the triple digits. Some places in the deserts and interior valleys of California, Arizona, and Nevada will once again hit the 110s and 120s. The Las Vegas Valley, home to about 2.3 million people, was under an excessive heat warning that runs until Friday night. Wednesday was the fifth straight day that the daytime high reached or exceeded 115 degrees, a record. At this point, forecasters expect Saturday's high will reach 113 degrees, but there's some chance it also hits 115, which would mean 8 days in a row of such extreme temperatures, doubling the previous record of 4 days. Overnight in Las Vegas, the temperature dipped to 93 degrees, which Morgan Stessman, a Weather Service meteorologist, said was the highest low ever recorded on July 11th. By about 4 a.m. on Thursday, a car's thermometer, questionable as it might be, reported that it was 107 degrees outside. The official reading at that hour was 97 degrees at Harry Reid International Airport, according to the Weather Service, headed for a projected afternoon high of about 118 degrees, which would be a record for July 11th. Before this week, it would have broken the city's all-time record, too. Right now, it's just a matter of getting inside, being smart as far as hydrating yourself, and just living your life as well as you can, said Oscar Goodman, who moved to Las Vegas in 1964 and later served as mayor for 12 years before he relinquished the job to his wife. Thank God we have enough air conditioning here that people are comfortable, once they get inside, of course. An irrepressible better, Mr. Goodman said that he had tried without success to persuade the city's books to accept a wager on how high the temperatures would get during this heat wave. He would not confess whether he was joking. For good measure, he threw in a reference to the city's history with organized crime, but he said that he never remembered Las Vegas feeling so hot. This summer has given residents some time to get used to the heat, even as they have complained while walking to restaurants and shops in parts of Clark County away from the Las Vegas Strip. It has not been so simple for visitors like the Maddox family, so they have largely tried to stay inside where air conditioners rumble and strive to tame this temperature towards something tolerable. Las Vegas was not the Maddox's original ambition. They had planned to visit the Caribbean until Hurricane Beryl unleashed havoc there. With a week off work already arranged, they resolved to travel someplace anyway. Now they have heard no shortage of feedback from Louisiana, which has seemed mild by comparison. Everybody back at home is saying, "You're crazy. You went out there in July," Mr. Maddox said. He shrugged. Then he fished in his pocket for the rental car's key fob. He wanted to start the air conditioning before he got to the convertible. Moving back to the Stanford Advocate, quote, "a good show to enjoy under the stars," end quote. Stanford's Shakespeare on the Green returns with, quote, "The Taming of the Shrew," end quote. Byline Ignacio Laguarda. Dateline Stanford. A purple flag is flying at the top of the Shakespeare on the Green stage at Sterling Farms, meaning this year's installment of the annual free outdoor performance is a comedy. Quote, "The Taming of the Shrew," end quote, is the play chosen by Stanford production company Curtain Call for a series of performances set to kick off Thursday. Along the roof of the volunteer-built stage, the purple flag is raised higher than the other two flags, meant to represent genres within the famed playwright's extensive catalog. Red stands for tragedy, and green symbolizes history. The centered and highest flag represents the chosen play. Last year's production, which celebrated the 20th anniversary of the yearly tradition, was, quote, The Tempest, end quote. Prior to that, Curtain Call staged productions of, quote, Measure for Measure, end quote, in 2022, and Romeo and Juliet in 2021. A press release from Curtain Call described the Taming of the Shrew as, quote, a comedy that explores themes of courtship, gender roles, and societal expectations, end quote. It follows the courtship of Caterina and Petruccio in the Italian city of Padua. The city's subplot involves a group of suitors attempting to win the love of Bianca, Caterina's sister. Using farcical elements to examine the dynamics of relationships and the societal norms of the time, The Taming of the Shrew, even in today's world, is still a good show to enjoy under the stars, the release reads. Kyle Runestad, who directed all three previous Shakespeare on the Green performances, is back to direct again this year. The cast includes Kevin Thompson as Petruccio, Katie Laurie as Catherine, and Samantha Bauer as Bianca. Performances of The Taming of the Shrew will be held nightly at 7:30 p.m. on July 11th through the 14th, and the following week, July 18th through the 21st, on the Great Lawn alongside the Royal Green Restaurant, the sponsor of the event, at Sterling Farms on Newfield Avenue. The park opens to audience members at 6 p.m. each performance day. Food and beverages will be available in the adjoining tent or may be pre-ordered through the Royal Green Restaurant. More information is available at curtaincallinc.com or by calling 203-329-8207. Again, that's curtaincallinc.com or by calling 203-329-8207. Curtain Call recommends that attendees bring blankets or chairs. While it is free to attend any of the performances, Curtain Call suggests contributions of $20 for adults and $10 for seniors and children. Reserved seating, which will be limited, costs $25 per person. Moving now to the next article in The Advocate. Norwalk's Rico's Pizza to relocate to a sit-down restaurant with a bar. Byline Layla Schlack. Rico's Pizza has been serving takeout from 247 Connecticut Avenue in Norwalk since 2018, but that will soon change, according to a news release from the company. A new Rico's Pizza at 85 New Canaan Avenue, near the Norwalk-New Canaan border, will offer table service and a full bar. By moving our Norwalk location to our Broad River neighborhood, we have enabled the company to better serve its Norwalk and New Canaan customer bases, which are equally important, Rico's co-founder and CEO, Rico Imbrogno, said in the release. The new location will have a 37-foot-long bar with 25 seats, 32 tables, and 14 televisions, the release states. Last month, The Hour reported that Rico's Pizza will open a new location in Westport, too. While the Westport spot is being launched with a new franchisee group, according to the release, the New Canaan Avenue outpost will be owned by the corporation. Construction is beginning on the Norwalk location, the release states, and the company plans to have it open by late 2024 or early 2025. The Connecticut Avenue Rico's will remain in business until the new spot is ready for customers, and then it will close. The chain, which is known for its hot oil pizza, started in Stamford in 2011. The Westport resident will be Rico's sixth location in Connecticut, according to its website. Rico's has also expanded to Florida, Massachusetts, and New York, with spots opening soon in North Carolina and Vermont, its website states. Earlier this year, Rico's shared plans to franchise up and down the East Coast. In May, the company beat an eviction attempt in Stamford. Moving now to the Stamford Advocate business section. Inflation cools, paves way for potential cuts to Fed interest rates. Byline Christopher Rugeber, Dateline Washington. Inflation in the United States cooled in June for a third straight month, a sign that the worst price spike in four decades is steadily fading and may soon usher in interest rate cuts by the Federal Reserve. In a better-than-expected report, consumer prices declined 0.1% from May to June after having remained flat the previous month, the Labor Department said Thursday. It was the first monthly decline in overall inflation since May 2020, when the economy was paralyzed by the pandemic. And measured from 1 year earlier, prices were up 3% in June, cooler than the 3.3% annual rate in May. The latest inflation readings will likely help convince the Fed's policymakers that inflation is returning to their 2% target. A brief pickup in inflation early this year had caused the officials to scale back their expectations for interest rate cuts. The policymakers said they would need to see several months of mild price increases to feel confident enough to cut their key rate from its 23-year high. The June figures will qualify as another installment of the more good inflation data the central bank has been seeking. Should inflation remain low through the summer, most economists expect the Fed to begin cutting its benchmark rate in September. This confirms that there is very little chance of inflation reaccelerating and that it's time for some rate cuts from the Fed, said Luke Tilley, chief economist at Wilmington Trust, a wealth management firm. Tilley noted that measures of rent and home ownership costs cooled significantly last month, a long-awaited development. Rental prices typically don't change much from month to month, he noted, which means that the slower price increases in June will probably continue. Even as inflation slows, though, the costs of food, rent, healthcare, and other necessities remain much higher than they were before the pandemic, a source of public discontent and a potential threat to President Joe Biden's re-election bid. In June, gas prices plunged for a second straight month, tumbling 3.8% on average nationwide from May. Gas prices are now down 2.5% from a year ago. They did pick up this month and averaged $3.54 nationwide Thursday, according to AAA, up 10 cents from a month earlier. Grocery prices ticked up by a slight 0.1% last month, the first increase in 5 months, and are just 1.1% higher than a year ago. Food prices are still up, on average, 21% from March 2021, when inflation started to surge, although Americans' average wages have also risen sharply since then. Excluding volatile food and energy costs, so-called core prices climbed just 0.1% from May to June, below the 0.2% increase in the previous month. Measured from 12 months earlier, core prices rose 3.3% in June, down from 3.4% in May. Core prices are thought to provide a particularly telling signal of where inflation is likely headed. Moving now to our final article. IRS collects $1 billion in back taxes from wealthy. Byline Fatima Hussein, Dateline Washington. The IRS announced Thursday that it has collected $1 billion in back taxes from high-wealth tax cheats, a milestone meant to showcase how the agency is making use of the money it received as part of the Biden administration's signature climate, healthcare, and tax package signed into law in 2022. Part of the push for public awareness of high wealth tax collections is a growing recognition by agency officials that a potential Republican takeover of the White House and Congress could mean massive future budget cuts for the IRS. Showing the public how much work the IRS is getting done is meant to give the much maligned agency a more sympathetic image. As part of that effort, last year the IRS launched a series of initiatives aimed at pursuing high wealth individuals who have failed to pay their tax debts. The IRS says the campaign is focused on taxpayers with more than $1 million in income and more than $250,000 in recognized tax debt. President Biden's Inflation Reduction Act is increasing tax fairness and ensuring that all wealthy taxpayers pay the taxes they owe, just like working families do, Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen said in a statement. Well, that's all the time we have today. It's Friday, July 12, 2024. My name's Harold Topper, and I've been reading selected articles from today's editions of the New York Times, Norwalk Hour, and the Stanford Advocate. Please stay safe.